Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on President Harry S. Truman and the Korean War. We pick up the story on June 25th, 1950, the day after North Korea invaded South Korea. On Sunday evening, June 25th, 1950, President Truman arrived at Blair House, the presidential guest quarters across Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House, where the first family was residing during the three-year reconstruction of the crumbling executive mansion. First, Truman went upstairs to telephone his wife, Bess, that he had landed safely. Walking down the staircase, he vowed almost to himself, "We can't let the United Nations down. We can't let the United Nations down." Then Truman joined a dozen guests for cocktails in the garden, including his secretaries of state and defense, his chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Omar Bradley, and other military and diplomatic officials. Dining at 7:45 that evening, with the French doors flung open to admit the soft evening breeze, President Truman later wrote his wife, Bess, that the downstairs rooms were very hot. Truman did not get down to business until the meal, which consisted of fried chicken, asparagus, biscuits, shoestring potatoes, and vanilla ice cream with chocolate topping, was over, and the servers were out of earshot. That afternoon, in a special Sunday session, 10 members of the United Nations Security Council, still housed in temporary quarters at Lake Success in New York, had, upon American request, convened around a horseshoe-shaped table to discuss the North Korean invasion. In protest of the Council's failure to unseat a delegate from Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist Chinese regime after Mao's revolution in China, the Soviet envoy was absent and hence unable to veto a U.S. proposed resolution to condemn the unprovoked attack on South Korea and demand an immediate halt to hostilities and removal of the President of North Korea's Kim Il-sung's troops. As President Truman later recalled, all of his Blair House guests were agreed on whatever had to be done to meet this aggression by North Korea. General Omar Bradley noted intense moral outrage. Secretary of State Dean Acheson observed great confusion about the crisis. The chiefs of the Air Force and Navy, General Hoyt Vandenberg and Admiral Forrest Sherman, argued that aiding their South Korean counterparts might be sufficient. The Army Chief of Staff, General J. Lawton Collins, warned that the South Korean army might really be broken, which would require the insertion of U.S. ground troops. Dean Rusk, now Assistant Secretary of State for Asia, warned that if the communists took all of Korea, it would be a dagger pointed at the heart of Japan. All of them were grimly aware that the Soviet Union was now, as it had been for a year, an atomic power. Bradley insisted that the Soviets were obviously testing us in Korea, stating, "Russia is not yet ready for war, and the line ought to be drawn now." This was in spite of Bradley's urging the previous year that American troops be withdrawn from Korea because the country had so little strategic importance and would be so difficult to defend. Bradley said now, "We should act under the guise of aid to the United Nations." President Truman agreed, almost emphatically, that the line must be drawn. Predicting that North Korea would not pay any attention to the United Nations, he warned that the United States would have to use force if the order was to be obeyed. The Russians were trying to get Korea by default, gambling that we'd be afraid of starting a third world war and would offer no resistance. The United States was still holding the stronger hand, but how much stronger was hard to tell. General Vandenberg warned that a considerable number of Russian jets are based on Shanghai, China. The president asked Vandenberg whether we could knock out their bases in the Far East. General Vandenberg replied that this might take some time, but it could be done if we used atomic bombs. Truman asked for a contingency plan to wipe out all Soviet air bases in the Far East. James Webb began to describe what South Korea's defense would require in terms of American domestic politics. "We're not going to talk about politics," Truman exclaimed. "I'll handle the political affairs." He directed that MacArthur send weapons to South Korea and that the 7th Fleet keep Mao's China from attacking Chang's outpost on Formosa, Taiwan. Before the dinner ended, the president asked his guests not to speak to the press, even on background, stating it was absolutely vital that there should be no leak. Around 11, the officials slipped out of Blair House through the back door. Staying behind, Secretary of State Dean Acheson showed the president a cable from John Foster Dulles, the New York Republican lawyer diplomat who would have been Secretary of State had Truman been defeated by Thomas Dewey in 1948. Dulles, now a part-time advisor to the State Department, had just arrived in Tokyo from Korea. In his dispatch, he warned that if South Korea could not repulse the northern attack, U.S. force should be used even though this risks Russian countermoves. To sit by while Korea is overrun by unprovoked armed attack would start a disastrous chain of events leading most probably to world war. Dulles' recommendation meant that internationalist Republicans would probably back Truman if he acted forcibly in Korea. It also may have been a veiled warning that if the president did not so respond, those same Republicans might denounce him for cowardice. At the core of Harry Truman's reputation was decisiveness. Fully in character, he had quickly drawn a conclusion as to what the North Korean attack meant and how America should retaliate. However, as we can now understand from Soviet evidence released later in the 1990s after the Cold War ended, Truman's interpretation of the invasion was not accurate. Its chief architect had not actually been Stalin, but Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea. To be sure, Joseph Stalin had secretly offered Kim a green light. If the plan worked, the invasion of South Korea, it would be a low-cost way to steal South Korea from the Western orbit. But the Soviet leader had made it plain that if Kim needed additional ground forces, he would have to get them not from the Soviet Union, but from Mao in China. On Monday, June 26, 1950, Truman was reminded of his decision to bolster Turkey and Greece against Soviet subversion in 1947 under his newly invented Truman Doctrine. The outwardly unflappable President Truman now confided in a letter to his wife, Bess, stating, "Haven't been so upset since Greece and Turkey fell into our lap. Let's hope for the best." Truman fully shared Dean Acheson's view that this crisis could be a turning point in world history, telling his young aide, George Elsey, "Korea is the Greece of the Far East. If we just stand by, they'll move into Iran and take over the whole Middle East. There's no telling what they'll do if we don't put up a fight now." That morning, Dean Acheson called Wisconsin's Alexander Wiley, ranking Republican in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, assuring Wiley that the South Koreans were in good fighting shape. Acheson hoped that, within a very short time, he or President Truman could consult with Wiley's panel at the Senate. Senator Wiley asked if the Soviets were involved in the North Korean attack. Dean Acheson said there was no evidence of this, despite the strong suspicion that it had been stimulated by the Russians. Calling the West Virginia Democrat John Key, chairman of the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee, Secretary of State Acheson warned that Korea was a delicate situation at the present, And at this opening moment, it really has to be in hands of the president. Key called him back that afternoon to ask for a briefing. Acheson said it would be pretty difficult to do that now because there are new reports from Korea that things were not going so well. American supplies might not be able to get in. Shaken and weeping, the South Korean ambassador to the United States, Chang Myon, arrived at the West Wing at the White House, which was untouched by the mansion's construction work, and pleaded with Truman for all possible aid to his country's forces, which were deficient in artillery, tanks, and aircraft. Truman replied that help was on the way, but South Koreans must continue to fight effectively. Truman noted that the battle was only 48 hours old, and that freedom fighters in other countries had defended their liberties under much more discouraging situations through to ultimate victory. Senator Stiles Bridges, Republican from New Hampshire, was one of the foremost leaders of the powerful China lobby, which demanded to know only a year before who lost China, and backed Chiang Kai-shek's return to the Chinese mainland, there to supposedly overthrow Mao. Now Senator Bridges was asking, will we continue appeasement? The California Republican Senator William Nolan warned that if South Korea were allowed to succumb, there would be little chance of stopping communism anywhere on the continent of Asia. Senator Tom Connelly of Texas, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, assured his colleagues that the President of the United States is not going to sell out the interests of the United States or its people. He is not going to tremble like a psychopath before the Russian power. But the post-World War II isolationist Senator Robert Taft told reporters that while North Korea's attack might jeopardize U.S. prestige, it was hardly cause for the nation to enter another war, stating, in Korea, as a result of the full policy of Yalta in 1945, the communists have control of half the country. We assigned them half the country. Let them set up an army and get ready. That evening, Truman dined at Blair House by himself, then gathered another war council at 9 o'clock. General MacArthur was reporting from Tokyo that a complete collapse is imminent in South Korea. General Collins told Truman that the South Korean chief of staff had no fight left in him. Dean Acheson insisted that it was important for us to do something in Korea, even if the effort is not successful. General Vandenberg reported that the first Yak plane, meaning the Soviet-built Yakovlev Yak-9 fighter flown by North Korea, had been shot down. Truman said he hoped it was not the last. Everyone present knew that throughout World War II, Franklin Roosevelt had avoided sending U.S. ground forces to the Asia mainland. General Omar Bradley now told Truman that they should study the potential dangers for at least a few days before he made a choice so fateful. For the moment, the president just chose to aid the South Koreans with Navy and Air Force, but not ground troops. Nor would American sailors or airmen be allowed to operate above the 38th parallel, that being the border between North and South Korea, at least not yet. Dean Rusk suggested that if the Soviets were to make another move against the West, Formosa, Taiwan, would be the next likely spot. The president said he wouldn't give Chiang Kai-shek and his forces a nickel for any purpose whatsoever, noting that all the money we have given them is now invested in United States real estate. Truman went on, I don't want to go to war, explaining, everything I have done in the past 5 years as president has been to try to avoid making a decision such as I had to make tonight. He asked General Bradley whether he should mobilize the National Guard to fight in Korea, noting that the National Guard had some pretty good air. If so, he would go to Congress to ask for funds. General Collins told the president, "If we are going to commit ground troops in Korea, we must mobilize." After the meeting, the president told Dean Acheson and his Assistant Secretary of State for United Nations Affairs, John Hickerson, "Now let's all have a drink. It's been a hard day." Over a glass of bourbon, Truman told them, "I have hoped and prayed that I would never have to make a decision like the one I've just made today, but I saw nothing else that was possible for me to do. Now with this drink, that's out of my mind." Truman further explained, "I did this for the United Nations. I believed in the League of Nations. It failed. Lots of people thought that it failed because we weren't in to back it up. Okay, now, we started the United Nations. It was our idea, and in this first big test, we just couldn't let them down. If a collective system under the United Nations can work, it must be made to work, and now is the time to call their bluff." On Tuesday morning at 8:30, having summoned leaders of Congress to the Cabinet Room, Truman read aloud a statement he was about to issue, saying that the North Korean attack makes it plain beyond all doubt that communism has passed beyond the use of subversion to conquer independent nations and will now use armed invasion and war. Providing assistance to help the United Nations fulfill its resolution, he would send United States air and sea forces to give the Korean government troops, cover, and support. Maryland's Senator Millard Tydings informed Truman that the Senate Armed Services Committee, of which he was chairman, had that morning endorsed extending the military draft. Some of the Republicans present were startled that Truman had moved so far towards war without making any serious effort to consult Congress in advance. New Jersey's Charles Eaton, ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, asked him if the United States was now committed to defend South Korea from invasion. Truman crisply replied that his statement made this clear. Another New Jersey Republican, Senator H. Alexander Smith, wished to know whether he intended to ask Congress to pass a resolution endorsing American military action in the Korean struggle. Cagedly, Truman replied that he would take it under advisement. That afternoon in the Oval Office, Dean Acheson urged the president not to ask for a congressional endorsement for his action in Korea. Events were moving too quickly. Were he still a senator, Truman might have objected had a president grabbed such unilateral authority for himself, but he now complied with his own Secretary of State. Congress and the country were already consumed by arguments over the loss of China and suspected Soviet spies, such as Alger Hiss, who had been convicted of perjury in January 1950 after dramatic hearings that starred the young Congressman Richard Nixon of California. The president had no stomach to drag the issue of war in Korea into this morass, and he knew that time was of the essence. That evening, after American lobbying, the United Nations Security Council specifically asked its members to respond to North Korea's aggression with military force. Senator Robert Taft was furious at Truman's effort to steamroll Congress. On Wednesday, June 28, 1950, he took the Senate floor to denounce the president's bungling and inconsistent foreign policy, culminating with the North Korean attack. He complained that the president had not consulted, only informed, congressional leaders about his response. While conceding that America's obligations as a U.S. member had changed traditional considerations, Senator Taft proclaimed, "I do not think it justifies the present action without approval of Congress. If it is what it seems to me, it is a complete usurpation by the president of authority to use the armed forces of this country. If the president can intervene in Korea without congressional approval, he can go to war in Malaya or Indonesia or Iran or South America." Senator Taft also complained that in his January National Press Club speech, Dean Acheson had encouraged the North Koreans to presume that the United States would not defend the South. Taft called for the Secretary of State's resignation to the applause of Acheson's chief Senate enemies, William Jenner of Indiana and Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. In February, McCarthy had given his notorious speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, charging that the U.S. State Department was riddled with secret communists. "We are now actually engaged in a de facto war with the North Korean communists," Senator Taft warned, stating, "That in itself is serious, but nothing compared to the possibility that it might lead to war with Soviet Russia." Thus, Taft pledged to support a congressional resolution supporting the president's decision and any Americans fighting in Korea. Defending Truman, the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Lucas of Illinois, replied that when Taft blamed everything in Korea on the president, the only thing such action does is to help Mr. Stalin. That same day, the president wrote Senator Joseph O. Mahoney, a Wyoming Democrat, that by using the Navy and Air Force to aid South Korea, we will either get the results or we will have to go all out to maintain our position. He told his National Security Council that he was doing his best to avoid any feeling of panic and to keep people from being scared, but did not intend to back out of the fight with North Korea unless they should develop a military situation which we had to meet elsewhere in the world. Truman also pondered a cabled warning from his ambassador in Seoul, Korea, John Muko, that the situation had deteriorated so rapidly that if the president had not opted to aid the South Koreans, it was doubtful any organized Korean resistance would have continued through the night. On Thursday, June 29, 1950, at 4 p.m., Truman met the press in the Indian Treaty Room of the Executive Office Building. No longer the intimate, casual session around the oval desk that it was under Franklin Roosevelt, the presidential press conference was now larger and more formal, while the reporters still had to secure the president's permission to quote him. Truman was told, "Everybody is asking in this country, are we or are we not at war?" Truman replied, "We are not at war." Asked if reporters could publish that reply, he consented. Another question was asked, "Are we going to use ground troops in Korea?" "No comment on that," responded the president. Someone asked him about any possibility of having to use the atomic bomb. Ominously, Truman replied, "No comment." Asked to elaborate on his decision to aid the South Koreans, Truman replied, for a quotation, that their country had been set up with the United Nations help and was unlawfully attacked by a bunch of bandits. United Nations members were going to do the relief of the Korean Republic to suppress a bandit raid. Asked about Taft's demand for Acheson to resign, Truman replied that Senator Taft's political statement at this time is entirely uncalled for. Someone asked him, "Would it be correct against your explanation to call this a police action?" Truman said, for a quotation, "Yes, that is exactly what it amounts to." Final question of Truman: "Mr. President, your no comment on the atomic bomb might be subject to misinterpretation. Has there been any change?" Truman interrupted by saying, "No comment will be made on any matter of strategy." Headlines after the press conferences touted the president's impromptu endorsement of the term police action. At a 5 p.m. National Security Council meeting in the Cabinet Room, Lewis Johnson read out a new directive that the Joint Chiefs of Staff wished to cable to General MacArthur in Tokyo. Expanding the general's mission, it would authorize MacArthur to send ground soldiers to the Korean port city of Pusan, there to protect American supply and communication lines. Truman replied, "I do not want any implication in the letter that we are going to war with Russia at this time. we must be damn careful. We want to take any steps we have to push the North Koreans behind the line, but I don't want to get us overcommitted to a whole lot of other things that could mean war. He simply wished to destroy air bases, gasoline supplies, ammunition dumps, and places like that north of the 38th parallel, and keep the North Koreans from killing the people we are trying to save. Finally, the president told the Joint Chiefs that they could give General MacArthur all the authority he needs to do that, but he's not going to go north of the 38th parallel. Dean Acheson backed Truman's decision to send U.S. ground troops to Korea, stating, "It would be a great disaster if we were to lose now, and it is essential to give the commander on the spot whatever he needs to stop a disaster." Acheson insisted that U.S. soldiers be given the right to fight Soviet forces if they were encountered. They must have the right to defend themselves. According to the official record, everybody agreed. The Secretary of State said he was convinced that the Russians do not intend to enter directly into the Korean dispute. Consulted about offers of naval support and airplanes from U.S. allies, Truman ordered, "Take everything, we may need them." Truman complained that just as in World War II, it was hard to get information out of General MacArthur, and directed his aide Lewis Johnson to ask the general for daily reports on the fighting in Korea. He had no quarrel with anybody and did not intend to have one. He just wanted to know what the facts were, and I don't want any leaks. Reading from presidential historian Michael Beschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on President Harry S. Truman and the Korean War will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.